I'm going to jump right in because we've got a limited amount of time and we all know what we're here for. But I wanted to say that the last time I saw Martin in London, which was actually just a few weeks ago, we touched on the talk that we're doing today as I was leaving. We were saying goodbye, and Martin asked me, have I seen all of Chantal Ackerman's films? And I thought, that's interesting. I'm not sure how that relates to our talk. And then he said, I'm going to see a number of them before the talk. And then I realized he thought the talk was going to be about my work, not his. So I said, this, Marty, is about you. It's about your films. And I'm telling you that because it's an indication of this man's incredible generosity and support and interest in other people and what they're doing and an incredible compassion for the world. And it's an opportunity for me to thank him for all the support he's given me, but not only myself, but many, many other filmmakers and cinema in general. We're all incredibly grateful. And for me, it's I think it's a very unusual thing that this generosity of spirit, this beautiful soul that Marty has, is combined with being really the greatest living film director we have. So I want you to give a very warm welcome to Martin.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Wow. Come on. Thank you.
Wow. So, I wanted to jump right into filmmaking itself, and it always strikes me that whenever I see a director working, that what you're dealing with every day are very practical things, and often with a big crew, and I'm interested in how you keep your vision of what you want to do, your ideas intact with all this kind of craziness around.
I think it has a lot to do with the preparation that I work on, which is I usually try to lock myself away for at least 10 days or almost 2 weeks just to sit with the script and the ideas of the script and try to come up with a visualization of the picture. That is, in a sense, really designing certain editing sequences, but at the same time also allowing, let's say, I don't know, 5 or 6 pages of dialogue and saying, no, that's going to depend on the location, that's going to depend on, you know, the day, the time of day in shooting, and then really it's a matter of sometimes who's in the frame and who isn't in a scene that takes place between two people, for example. But that changes, for example, that frees me in a way so that section of the script, when I get the location or I get the set, I could then rework it with the actors. So that still is still alive in a way. And I have to figure out, too, whether I even need wide shots, in a sense, of something like that. But I usually like to think about what I used to call the philosophy of the shot. You know, what the shot is saying. Does it have a narrative point to it? And if it's a tracking shot, the head of the shot, the tail of the shot, where we start and where we end. It's very difficult because I like moving camera, but at the same time, we tend to say, okay, we're going to start the shot here and track all along the audience right this way. But I know now over the years that I lose the head and tail of the shot. So maybe I want to start a little sooner in here and move it this way, but it's not long enough, so I got to go back a bit. So it's that kind of thing. And should the camera be on an angle, or should it be on an angle, or should it be just like a Godardian kind of parallel track, head on? And so that really is a different effect to the viewer, you know, particularly if you're head on and you're tracking, you know. And I kind of like that, just moving back and forth this way, following. I remember a scene in Viva Savi where Anna Karina, the guy comes in and asks for a Judy Garland record, and it just tracks through the record store. And she goes and gets the record and just tracks back. And it had a kind of clarity, and it said so much about the quotidian work that she was doing, the daily work. And it didn't interfere, and it didn't impress, it didn't force the audience to make, it wasn't forcing a comment, but you felt you were there with her in a way, and almost her boredom, in a sense, of what she was doing in that film.
Do you think, though, when you're in that moment of shooting something like that, have you already worked that out? As you say, you storyboard and you prepare a lot,
yeah.
but do you often, in the moment, see something and think, well, I want to capture it actually a different way because it's worked out differently in front of you?
Well, there's a double-edged sword there, in that if we're really moving quickly, and, for example, we're in a situation where the budget and the time, I know I need that shot. I know that's the shot that's going to tell me something. On the other hand, if I have some extra time and I find something with the actor, or he or she, I tend to say, okay, I can cover that this way, or I can do it in this, or could we combine it in the shot? But, you know, it's difficult, because if you're doing a parallel track and you have the actor coming in and out, so to speak, forward and back, that changes the tone of the shot. So that's got to be taken into consideration. Again, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes more time is a problem because you tend to add more shots. And I like to think of the shots, I like to think of it as a very precise process. I don't necessarily like shooting, you know, so much footage that we wind up doing it only in the editing. You follow?
Yes, yeah. And do you think that thinking has come partly because you began as an editor, in fact?
Yes, I think so. I think I was very affected by, there's no doubt, I was very affected by American films, Hollywood films. And when I say that, you know, you're talking of the grand style of, you know, William Wyler, John Ford, Howard Hawks, the wide shot, the long takes. Now, you got to understand that when I saw them in the 1940s, I was maybe 7 or 8 years old or whatever, 5 years old. But when I saw them, those screens were built for a place like this. It was a giant screen, even bigger, so that a wide shot played, you know, from, they call it the American shot, from right below the knee up, and you could let it play. And as television came in and things like that, well, you know, the images started to change. And so for me, I began noticing editing. Of course, when I saw Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, on television, by the way, with commercials. It was so awful, but you know, it didn't matter. At that time, it was the only way you could see it. Then The Third Man, Carol Reed's Third Man, which was shot in Vienna. And then, of course, I found myself going to these obscure theaters in New York, and the real awakening was really the Soviet editing of Potofkin, Tsigar Bertov, and Eisenstein. And so this for me was very exciting. Right at the same time, the editing was being redefined by the French and the Italian New Wave, by Godard and Truffaut and Rivette and so many others. And in Italy you had, you know, the humanism of Olmi, for example, with Il Posto and the beautiful film The Fiancés. This is before he made The Tree of the Wooden Clogs. And then you had the younger directors. You had Bertolucci and Bellocchio, and they were redefining it. The poetry was right there up front with Pasolini, in a way. The lens as a stilo, you know, the pen of the poet, in a way. And so there was... the early, late 50s and early 60s was a very, very important time for redefining how you tell a story with pictures, let alone Fellini's films and then the 360, no, the 180, I'd say, in style of Antonioni, which made us rethink screen time, you know, and taught us a great deal about structure in editing.
So, yeah, interesting to absorb all those different, very different styles
all,
in a
all
way.
All at the same time, yeah. By the way.
Yeah.
All at the same time. And going through all of that, you had Bergman. Bergman was always there. Every year was always like there was the Bergman film. And we, like, got so spoiled. You know, it's, oh, another Bergman. It's got to be good. You know, and there may be some, some people don't understand that at that time, his films were revolutionary in a way, particularly that trilogy that he did that ends with Through Glass Darkly. And then he took off and did Persona, and that became something else entirely. He was reaching out and finding new territory, pretty much the way Fellini did and Antonioni did with Red Desert, you know.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I haven't really thought the way you're describing it. You think of your cinema and how your there are elements of all those filmmakers you've mentioned in a way that you, but then you're making it your own, and the spiritual side obviously of Bergman's work, and then the expressionist style that you describe. It's.
I think the key was. Again, coming from a family that was literate, but there were no books in the house, so I had to learn to read novels or read history books. It took me a long time to learn how to live with a book, in a way, and not to be intimidated by it, the length, etc. The literature I was exposed to at the time was Graham Greene and Dostoevsky. And Melville and that sort of thing. And so for me, Dostoevsky was the key, Notes from Underground and Brothers Karamazov. But the interesting thing in terms of the spirituality was Dostoevsky, but also Pasolini's Acatone. Yeah. That was a film that actually spoke to me directly about, the world I came from, so to speak.
Which I want to go into that in more depth, and I wonder, just staying on the film set for a bit longer. I'm looking at your shoes, which are really beautiful, and you mentioned to me the other day about shoes being really important to you when you're on set.
Well, yes, because one thing a director really has to have, as best as he or she can, is to have strong legs. Because you have to keep getting up, jumping up, and you need your knees. You know, the knees start to go. It's a problem. So the shoes are really important. Over the years, like I did Mean Streets, I had Fry boots at that time. Western boots was kind of a thing in the early 70s in L.A. You went cowboy, you know. And it also was a way to get away from where I came from. I was redefining. People tell me now, you're reinventing yourself. Yeah, that's what we were doing. You know, the next year I did a film called Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And at that time we were in Arizona, in New Mexico. And it was in Tucson, Arizona. And I was told that, you know, you really need earth shoes. I don't know if anybody remembers them.
What are earth shoes?
I don't know. They're not very nice looking, but they were really comfortable. That was part of the whole earth catalog and that sort of thing in the 60s. And things that we do now that basically, a lot of it is common sense now, but at that time was considered radical, you know. And so earth shoes, and that gave way then to, you know, shooting in the city, which was different. Shooting in the city, I was able to use regular shoes, like two-tone shoes and that sort of thing. The thing about the shoes is very important because, you know, if you're sitting a lot and you're moving a lot, I like to look at them. And it makes me think. I'm seeing perforated tips here, and it makes me think while I'm waiting. I'm looking. I like to look at it. It's true. It's true because it focuses your attention, you know. Yeah. And so the only problem is, I must say, as you get older, you do need more comfortable stuff. And so I did revert to these. They're sneakers called Nokas or something like that. They have a really good thick sole to them, and they actually was great because when you got up from your chair, you could be propelled forward and just dash into everybody and then pull back. And it was kind of interesting because I was able to keep my balance on them, but that was good. That was good. But not all the scenes. Other scenes I had very nice shoes.
So the shoes influenced the films, in fact?
Oh, totally, for me, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the other shoes I had made suede shoes with white stitching so I could look at the stitching. I mean, you don't need that, okay? But after all these years, I figured, well, what the hell, you know?
No, it's great. I think it's time to see our first clip. Well, I mean, there are a lot of things to talk about from that scene, but when I rewatched it recently, what I picked up particularly, apart from the amazing performances, and I think that De Niro's presence, it's just so palpable. He's so extraordinary. But it's just this idea that you become your job, and I wondered, as a film director, how does the job of being a film director affect you in your life? Maybe to explain further in terms of the question, I mean, I find that I think I catastrophize a lot. I dramatize things and I try and control other people's conversations. And I just wonder in what, maybe
that's
it's just
about
a direct.
It. That's about right, yes, yeah. I've been told I've been overly dramatic in my life, you know. Catastrophize, you're absolutely right, because most things are a catastrophe. And all you could do is write it out. You know, I feel like Wizard here. You know, he doesn't give him really any advice. It's the advice is to hang in and write out the storm, because it's a storm, you know. It's beautiful, there's beauty in it, but it's a storm. And that's why I haven't seen this scene, I think, maybe in 40 years. Yeah. And I'm interested, I remember now, frame by frame in the editing, making sure that there was enough of silences in it. And De Niro's, his hesitation, when he finally does say something, there's a line I remembered best was, you know, I got some bad ideas in my head. And he has that smile when he says it because he's embarrassed by it. And he's horrified at his own thoughts. And tragically, it comes to play at the end of the story. But in any event, we played in the editing on that primarily elongating that performance, really. The hesitation. All those hesitations ultimately building up to the violence in the picture. You know, we cut this in 75, the film was released in 76. But shooting so quickly at that time, designed the shot, there's a storyboard for it. It's outside the Belmore Cafeteria. The Belmore Cafeteria was a famous all-night cafeteria for cab drivers. Cab drivers frequented it. And so it's closed now, but we made sure that Michael Chapman and I had the Belmore reflection behind them, that the cab is in a certain way there in the right of the frame. And then when De Niro's shot, he's single. And what I decided throughout the movie as best as possible was to isolate him so that when we talk about what a shot means, whenever we shoot De Niro's character in the film, he's single in the frame. And when he's on other people, he's usually in their frame. And so it kind of is off-putting in a way. He's never part of them. And so you see a little of that here, you know. But becoming what you are, I mean, you know, can you direct your life? I don't see how you can.
You try, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we were talking about this the other day, you mentioned Basil Fawlty. And for anyone who doesn't know who Basil Fawlty is, it was a 70s sitcom called Fawlty Towers. But I wonder what you have in common with Basil Fawlty, because it's very hard to see.
Of every little thing that bothered him, every petty thing, stuff that you shouldn't let, you know, stuff that you should meditate and get transcend. No, if you actually start, you know, if you actually say, well, you know, the floor is this way, and that's, and so he gets annoyed at, he lets everything get him. And the best thing to do is to, Basil Fawlty, the best thing to do is to just jump into it, accept it, and just complain about everything. Complain about everything, about the weather, about the people, about this, about that, until finally the absurdity of it makes itself clear and you start to laugh. There's a famous scene, I think, in Fawlty Towers where he has this silly car. I forget what it is. It's a small car, a little red car.
A Mini Cooper,
I think it is. And at one point, the car always keeps breaking down. And at one point, he's in the middle of the field or forest or whatever, and he's frantic because he's in trouble. He's got to get someplace. And the car breaks down. He gets out and he says to the car, "Okay, that's it." And he takes a twig and starts hitting the car, which I thought was, of course, it's not the car's fault, it's his fault, you know. And so once you understand the absurdity of it all, it's good. For me, I like complaining about it. Yeah. I like complaining about everything. And I think, but honestly, too, I think what happens for me is that because you've got to get through it. And if it's inconvenient, too bad. You know, you got to accept it. It's like for many years after making the lower budget films, when films got a little, when I had longer shooting schedules at times, I think it was King of Comedy, I would show up very late because King of Comedy became a film that I took on as a kind of, almost like I was convinced by De Niro to do it. And I wasn't quite ready for it because I didn't realize how much of myself was in it. And I was mortified by it. And every day, despite the fact that the actors were there and everything, I would always be late. Yeah.
How late?
Oh, a couple of days. I wasn't feeling well. No, this was a serious kind of... I could not bring myself to deal with these characters. And De Niro was fine, Diane Abbott, Sandra Bernhardt, Lewis was fine, Jerry Lewis, but... I began to realize that ultimately and it took about 90 some odd days shooting, and it was grueling for me because I didn't know how else to go through it except to live through the Rupert and Jerry and some of Sandra Bernhardt too, Masha. And so I was very upset by the picture, but I couldn't show that to them. I was trying to keep my spirits up and that sort of thing, but it was a very disturbing film for me to make. And so I think part of that had to do with my own fantasies of what imagined lives would be, the imagined life of the celebrity, and then the truth of the celebrity life that Jerry reflects, the humor and the nastiness of it, which is, later on, you know, Jerry Lewis, Don Rickles, you get all of that in there, that one has to, you know, deal with that humor comes out of very often other people's problems, you know? And so one has to not shy away from that, one has to understand that. Ultimately, I realized after the making of that film that I better be on time from now on, because when I get there, I still have to go through it. You still got to do the day, yeah. And you got to do the week, and then you got to do the month, and then you got to make the film. Or you have to go to this event, or you have to go to a friend's situation. Or you know, these days are terrible, but you go to funerals, you go to memorial services, you've got to do it. And you might as well get there on time, because it's not going to go away, you know. And so I was reticent on that film. And they all wondered why, but I had a hard time getting through it.
Wow. And I mean, being possessed by those three characters, that's an incredibly intense thing. It sounds exhausting.
It was very upsetting. The best part was finally the last few weeks, my mother showed up in the film, and she plays Rupert's mother, the voice above. He's in his basement, and that was a set. And we just put my mother and up above, and we just had her improvise. She said, "What's that noise down there? Who are you talking to? Who's this Gerald you're talking to?" And at one point, he said, "Has so-and-so been down here?" He mentions the name of his... He invented a brother that he had. We improvised. And he said, has Gerald been down here? I forget his name. Has Sammy been down here? He's going into my things. I'm going to get a killer attack dog. And then we'll see. And she goes, good, another mouth to feed. And then De Niro started laughing. And I never saw him crack up in the middle of a take. And he put his back to the camera, started shaking his shoulders, laughing. I said, what's he doing? My mother would not take anything from him. Whatever was going on. So that opened up. But that was the last few weeks of shooting. But for me, I found that particularly the scene where he shows up at Jerry's house with Diane. And they start dancing. Then Jerry shows up. And it's mortifying. You know, I know it's a comedy of errors. It's a comedy of manners, right? Is that what you...
Yes.
You know. And don't forget, that film was a complete... disaster at the box office. No one went to see it in America. It had a following in England. I remember.
It was straight after the release.
They liked it very much, picked up on it. But in America, what had happened with that picture was the, right after Raging Bull, the film that 2 years later to come out with De Niro and me directing, I think audiences expected something more on the lines of Raging Bull. And they didn't want Rupert Pupkin at all. Yeah. So in effect, I guess Rupert became, I think, our culture, really, in America.
Yeah, it's more and more relevant, I think, in many ways. I mean, reluctantly, because I know this is going to be the challenge today, sort of wanting to stay with subjects, but to try and keep the what we want to get to. And you've just been talking about your mother. I'm interested. I come from a family who were not intellectuals and they weren't artists. So, becoming a filmmaker, you know, I had to sort of, you know, find in the dark myself how to be. And I wondered, it's similar for you, not the same exactly, obviously.
Yes, it was. It was. I mean, naturally, they weren't. They were born in the on the streets of, in the tenements, not in hospitals. They were the children of immigrants from Sicily. And basically, they were only interested in survival in New York. Didn't really go to school. So the art around me was through radio, television, when we had a TV. The street was very much great storytelling. Storytellers on the street corners or in sitting around the table at night, my mother telling stories, my father, my uncles, this sort of thing. There was a cutoff. There was another language issue, which I reacted against. I didn't want to learn the Sicilian. For my grandparents seemed to be from another planet in a way.
You didn't want to
know? No, because I sensed there was something else outside besides this world that they were in. Yeah, and part of that had to do with being finding myself in the church around the corner, St. Patrick's Cathedral, a young priest who was like our mentor, who gave us Graham Greene to read, and James Joyce. And so for me, I knew there was another world out there. And so I had to do this in a way on my own. We would see these films, come back to my apartment, where I was living with my parents and my brother. And the best time for me was between 3 o'clock after school and 5:30 when my mother got home. And I would have to go down and help her with the groceries or whatever, because they would buy all the groceries fresh right there. And between those 2 hours, within those 2 hours, I was able to draw little stories, little drawings. Later on, I realized that they were like storyboards in a way. I was already planning camera moves and close-ups. The reason was that we couldn't afford a camera. And a friend of mine down the block had a camera. And so later on, I started playing with an 8mm camera. But primarily, it was my drawings. And in a way, I did it everything from, you know, the 1:3:3 aspect ratio, westerns, all sorts of stories. Then widescreen hit, and I had longer widescreen, 2:5:5 aspect ratio, Roman epics, you know, which I never finished. Made my own frames, yes, and had my own little theater that I'd push it through, and I'd show it to only one person, one or two people, and two of the more not street guys. They were more intellectual, put it that way. But they insisted that the images didn't move, and I insisted they did move. They did, because you have to go from the cut. In other words, the frame, not the next frame, so you have to imagine that the last frame now becomes this frame. Well, how did that happen? Is it a cut? Is it a move? And that sort of thing. And so, really, I was teaching myself all this. My parents, I would hide it from them because...
So they didn't see them?
Yeah. No, I would hide them because I was sick all the time. And, you know, quite honestly, they didn't know what to do with me. My brother and he had difficulties too, but troublesome. You could see a lot of it's reflected in the movies I make. But the two brothers, he was 7 years older than me. Was very loving the family, but he was a very at times sadly troubled guy. And so it was a very difficult place. I didn't want anybody to see this stuff, except two of my friends. And because my father saw me doing it once, and he was concerned that
About what?
Well, I brought into the house two books, one on the Russian Revolution by Alan Moorhead, and the other on Greek art.
So what was he worried would happen?
You're cutting paper dolls, he thought. You know, what are you doing? Who are you? What is this kid? You know, what's he going to be? You know, this is 1951, 52. It's what? 73 years ago in a working class family, you know, it's not, and here they are, the new generation. Who is this kid? You know, the older brother has troubles and this one is sick all the time. He's in the corner drawing pictures and cutting up little pieces of paper in color. What the hell is that? You know, and now he wants to, then at when I went to NYU, which was at the time Washington Square College, it was not the NYU of today. In effect, not putting it down, but in effect, if you were able to get the tuition, you could go to a certain extent. And because I had been in a preparatory seminary for the priesthood and I got thrown out, my high school period, that middle school period, my grades weren't very good and I couldn't get into the Jesuit schools. And so I went to NYU because they also had this film department, they called it. And about a year into it, I was saying that I think I can make films. And I heard, you know, there was only three rooms, and I could hear them at night sometimes talking in the bedroom. And I heard my mother say at one point, I think he's crazy. I think he's crazy. But she didn't know. You see, it was 60 and 61, and Cassavetes had made Shadows. And Shirley Clarke made, well, The Connection is one thing, but then she made The Cool World. And all this incredible stuff was going on with the American underground and then the French New Wave and the Italian New Wave. You could get, and the Maisels and Penny Baker and all these guys making films with the lightweight equipment. Well, that means that if you have something to say, you might be able to get it made. You don't have to go to California to get it made and work within a studio. And so there was a possibility. Although at NYU at the time, Haig Manoogian was our teacher, he would never... advocate making what we call now a melodrama. He said, if you come in with a script, first of all, you got to bring your own script in. You don't come in and say, I'm a director, I need a script. You got to write it yourself. And if you do, and if you put a gun in it, I'm throwing you out of class. He said, because that doesn't work here. He said, make a film about what it is to eat an apple. Interesting. A 5 to 6 minute film. How do you do that? It's interesting. Yeah. You know, make a film. Go to the Port Authority and work. See the guys on the docks and they're working. Talk to them. Go make a film on them. It was more documentary. More came out of the American Depression period, the WPA, Leo Hurwitz and all these guys, George Stoney making these incredible documentaries of that incredible movement that occurred under Roosevelt. You know, and so Haig came
so
from
he
that.
Was encouraging that, which yeah. I mean, not to bring it onto any of my work, but at film school, it's interesting because I was being encouraged to make documentary-like films,
yeah. Yes.
And
yeah.
But it wasn't where my head was at all. So,
I mean, mine either. And luckily, I came in with a script in 1963 for a small workshop. That was called the summer workshop. 6 weeks, you bring a script, you shoot it, you edit it, and then you cut the negative and you release, and there's a print. Maybe 30 young people would join up or for that class. Now, that class wasn't usually there during the year, during the regular semesters. There was a special class. That's actually where I met Thelma Schoonmaker. She was there in 63 at that one class. She never went to a film school that way. But in that one class, I was able to bring a script in. Before the class was called, he said, okay, you can go ahead and direct it. Other people came in and said, we want to direct, but they weren't. They basically became, you know, said, okay, you'll camera, you're on sound, you're on that sort of thing. And people always complained, oh, but I want to make a film. Well, you don't have a script. And so I made the script that way. And that actually was based on it was really an exploration of film language and humor from everything from the French New Wave to there's a great American comedian named Ernie Kovacs and Mel Brooks, you know. And so all of this was together. So that at that point, these films, and they started winning awards too. So that's when my parents thought that something was could be taken seriously.
Well, this is a good moment for the next clip. I was so struck when I watched Who's That Knocking at My Door again recently by, a moment like that, that has this silence to it.
Yeah, I know. That's the first time I've seen that since, maybe 50 years. I don't know, maybe more. I could have trimmed it. And that was we made that in 65, that scene. And then reshot some scenes with Zina Bethune, which you'll see later, in 67, and re-edited the film. The scenes with Zina were shot in 16 millimeter, and the scenes that you saw just now was 35 millimeter, which was the first time a student film was being shot in 35 in NYU. And that was Harvey Keitel there, a guy named Lenny Kuras, and a guy named Phil Carlson, I believe. In any event, I was obsessed with dissolves at the time, and I really liked the dissolves from the face, the sun, and that sort of thing. But in any event, it's based on something that happened to myself and my friends, and this guy took us away on a weekend up to a place called Copake, New York, and he had us climb up, and we saw the sunset, and it was beautiful, you know? I mean, shooting that, I didn't know how to shoot exteriors, because for me, an exterior, I mean, it's a joke, but it's true. An exterior for me is a long hallway with a light bulb because you come out of the apartment. So when you come out of the apartment, you're exterior. But that's a hallway. That's it. So apparently there's more outside. You know, and so here, I mean, I find, you know, over the years I learned, but to have been put into nature that way was something that it had a spiritual connection that I couldn't really explain it in any way. I didn't have the language for it except visually. And I had my close friend with me who was with me at the time was complaining about it all the time. And there was the one guy who took us up the mountain to take a look. A mountain for me, it's a hill, but it was very, very hard climbing. In fact, after shooting that, the sun went down. The thing I didn't realize about exteriors is when the sun goes down, it gets dark, and then you have to go down the hill. And it was dangerous. It was very dangerous, yeah. But there was that moment of peace and quiet, and then you cut to the city. It was interesting looking at the city again that way.
Yeah. And then the lighting of the candle made me think of Lawrence of Arabia in a way. Oh, I wonder if you thought about that when you were doing that.
Well, it that's a holy candle. That's in front of a Madonna that my mother had in her room.
I like the way that, later in the scene, JR, who's Harvey Keitel, complains about her using the candle.
Oh, yeah, well,
that's
a holy candle.
Because it's a holy candle.
Yeah, and she, you know, it just, the film is, in a sense, it was an attempt. I had wanted so much to make a breakthrough film at the time. Ambition is so important. But on the other hand, it could be so destructive. And so ambition is good for, in a sense, never giving in and never giving up. because you get discouraged all the way down the line for most that you do. My ambition, though, at the time wasn't well connected with the period that the world was going through. And in fact, in this film, Keitel's character falls in love with a young woman who is listed in the credits as the girl, and always gets laughs when that comes up. Basically, she comes from outside his world. And part of that is he's playing a Sicilian-American like myself, and she's blonde hair, blue-eyed, more Nordic, doesn't know his culture, doesn't understand his culture, and he doesn't know the outside world yet. And he's very naive, he's still very much a child. So for her to light a candle thinking it's romantic, it's a holy candle, I mean, it's out of the question.
And this film, you wrote, you weren't collaborating with another writer, were you, that you wrote this completely on your own?
Yes, yeah. And my old friend, Armenian friend of mine, Mardik Martin, would always be with me, and we'd work together.
Okay, and then you went on to Mean Streets together. I knew this would happen. The time is going so quick. Can we just not slow it down? Because there's so many things. Wanted to
No, it's a 17:50. What is it? 17. Oh, it's 6 o'clock already?
I can't believe it. I don't think we can go onto this quickly, but I suppose one of the reasons I wanted to show that clip was to move into the realm of the spiritual and move on to your later films and obviously The Last Temptation of Christ, which I rewatched the other day, and I'm still haunted by it. It's such it's such a beautiful, important film in so many ways. And Willem Dafoe, I don't know, did he? I don't think he got any awards for that, but he should have done.
Everyone rejected the picture except the director's branch of the Academy nominated me for directing. But what they did, in effect, was nominate themselves, because if I was kept from saying this in public or making a film like that, that would be the end of what they would be able to do. You understand? So they had to support you. And that was wonderful. That was good. Everyone else shunned us completely for that film. Yeah. But you know, the problem, it seems that even beyond filmmaking, the issue for me has always been that peace, a spiritual comfort that I found inside that. It's now called Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral. And this is rather important for me because that was the first Catholic cathedral in New York. It was built in 1810, so for America, that's very, very old. And, it's a very important church. It was under fire by the isolationists and racist groups in 1844 called the Know-Nothings and the Wide Awakes, with the eye looking around. We have certain aspects of that in Gangs of New York. In any event, they wanted Catholics out. They didn't want any Catholics in there. And that was the first cathedral in New York for Catholics. And so for me, I found coming from, it's a little bit of a connecting issue here, in that I was born in 42 in Queens, New York. My parents, when they got married, moved out of the neighborhood, moved out of the Lower East Side, which was, you know, tenements and difficulties and all kinds of problems, and got a nice little two-family house in Corona, Queens. And I grew up for the first 5 or 6 years of my life, maybe 7 years, in Queens, and it was so nice. There were trees and everything, even though I was allergic to them. I got very bad asthma at that time, and that I had to be taken care of all the time. I was kept from doing any sports or any running, or even spasmodic laughter, because that could cause problems with the lungs. But my father got into a big fight with the landlord, and we were forced to move out, and we were thrown back to the place that they were born in, on Elizabeth Street. And so the shock, the trauma, from going from something that I imagine still in my child's mind as idyllic, to basically the dead end kids, or like basically a Bruegel painting, thrown right in the center of it, you know, which is actually full of life and that sort of thing, but it was pretty terrifying. And so for me, the church represented a kind of comfort. And there was one particular priest who was very young who came into the neighborhood And he started to talk to us and open the world up to us, really.
When you say us, you
and... Myself and a few friends of mine, right. Yeah. And there was another group of friends who were not necessarily street tough kids. They were kids who went on to Fordham University and other universities. But the place was rife with, you know, it just, I have to say, there were representatives of the five crime families in New York on every corner. To this day, I can't tell you who they were or what it was because I was growing up with them. And we just knew that that's where the power was. And, you know, we had to be very respectful and we had to be very careful on certain issues and certain people. But not everybody wound up there. Others went to school. Others, and the priest came in and said, no, don't go there. You know, and also don't necessarily, you know, there was another way of thinking, and this has to do with the spirituality, in that if you're the son or daughter of immigrants, the automatic thing was like the old world of Sicily was to, at the age of 21, 22, get married and have a family. And he said, that's not necessarily the way in this country. There's another world out there. Learn more, read more, go to places, meet other people, learn other cultures, then maybe settle down if you can. And so that was an eye-opening experience. So for me, the spirituality, I wanted to be like him. And so I thought I'd be a priest. And it took me 3 or 4 months at that seminary to realize that, you know, you need more than that to take on a role that as a spiritual advisor to other people in life. It's about other people, not yourself. You see, it isn't saving yourself. I mean, yes, to a certain extent it is, but it has to do with others, not you. And I was completely bereft. I was thrown out, and I didn't know what to do. And I went to a Catholic high school, and during that high school, which, by the way, is the end of Killers of the Flower Moon, is shot in that high school at the radio show. Actually, they have a stage like this, even bigger. And so that high school kind of straightened me out in a way, and that led the way to cinema. But the spiritual quest or the search never left. And somehow it's reflected in that scene I haven't seen in, as I say, 50 some odd years.
Well, it's reflected in all your films, and having rewatched a lot of them, I mean, your curiosity about different cultures, that advice you were given... was about going into the priesthood, it completely applies to your body of work. I mean, in a way that I only feel that now, just having watched so many of the films, and it's really interesting when you watch a filmmaker's work in quite a concentrated amount of time, you really get a sense, I feel I've really got a sense of you and what your quest was and is, in a way.
Well, it's been a long... long ride, long journey, and we took a lot of wrong turns, you know. But, you know, we even took those moments where De Niro says, you know, I got some bad ideas in my head. We felt that way when we made that film. We felt that way when we did Raging Bull. But at the end of Raging Bull, he's able to sit there in a mirror and look at himself and be at some kind of peace, at least to the people around him, if not to himself. So the whole idea is forgiving yourself. That's one thing before you can forgive others, you know. And so it's a very interesting whether the word forgiveness comes in to play at all, as it means that who are you to judge in that sense too. But in the case of LaMotta, he was very, very judgmental that way in the character we created. Yeah. And by the end of the picture, he's reached some kind of peace. But even when I made that film, I didn't have it at the time. In other words, I was trying to get there to be able to look in the mirror, you see.
Well, I mean, it's painful to watch that scene when he's in the jail,
yeah.
And he's so self-destructive,
yeah. Yeah.
And hitting himself against the wall. It's really, I mean, I find it really upsetting and made me quite tearful. I mean, it's very emotional because you realize that all the hatred that he's been hitting out at other people is just all inside himself.
It's all inside himself, yeah. I mean, even on the set that day, my father was there, and because he's in the film, and the two guys who played the real guards, they're really prison guards, they were shocked by what he did in there. And you could feel it in the whole set just went into silence and quiet, you know, and it was a beauty. And it really worked. But that spiritual it seems the balance is always gone towards that, I think. And what I mean is that the projects that I've chosen or that have been, that I've had to be involved in, usually has an element of that in them. Yeah. Even the lack thereof, like in Wolf of Wall Street, which is really about, you know, where you have a society where the morality is so corrupted, and there's such a lack of spirituality that you want to go there to find out how we fill that, how we come to terms with that, you know. But the danger sometimes, especially when I was starting out, to go into dangerous areas, you may not come out. You just may not come out. You may not make it. And that's no matter, you know, you're self-destructive in any which way, whether it's being self-destructive just generally or whether you succumb to drink or drugs or that sort of thing. And it's a miracle that you get out of it, you know. But I felt to know where I was and how deep or how low the level could be reached, you see, what the lowest level could be. But it's just an amazing thing that suddenly you're still awake. And now what? Now there has to be another reason, and we go further. Yeah. And then another thing happens, and you're still awake, and you go further. Yeah. And a lot of people I know who didn't wake up.
Yeah. Well, you're still very much awake, and we're very happy you are. And I mean, yeah, I think we need to move on to the next clip. But yes, you are, I did want to ask, I don't know if we've got time to go further on this, but you are on this spiritual quest you're about to make.
Oh, well, again, it's a possible, after making the film Silence, it took me quite a number of years to be able to come to terms with the script of Silence, because I didn't quite fully know how to handle the scene in which he apostatizes, where Jesus tells him, "Step on me." That's why I was created. And I know that he found something deeper, and I want to go there now. And I don't know what it is. I'm not quite sure. But I think part of it is re-examining or trying to come to terms with the idea of a sort of universal compassion. And I think I try to deal with that in Kundun also. But here, I think it has to do with, for me, it's the concept of Jesus, this idea of Jesus, who he is, what is he, and what does it mean to me personally, and why am I going there? Maybe I'll find the way. I don't think I'll find an answer, but I'm going to try to maneuver my way through it to maybe come to some sort of a sense of peace, really, or at least some sort of comfort, not for myself, but for others, we hope. Sometimes these things speak to other people, too. I mean, Silence did, Last Temptation did. Many people told me that. Others, not. But that's all I know, really.
Let's have the next clip. Thank you. This is, just settle into this one.
Oh, this is longer. Yeah. Oh. It's a hard one to sit through for me. I haven't seen that since I made it. No. The two things about that, I was talking earlier about ambition, and I wanted to create something as, as I saw Before the Revolution by Bertolucci and the Fist in the Pocket by Bellocchio, and I wanted to make something as powerful as that immediately. And this is the story I came up with, but I think I had to live more in order to experience more, in order to make Mean Streets, for example, which was made 8 years later. But the thing about this, too, was that this film comes out. I remember my guys, my agents at the time, were laughing because they said, here's a world that, 1968, 69 is the height of the sexual revolution, and you have a film about a guy who loves this woman so much he won't make love to her. And they said, it's going to be laughed at. And so that's the nature of it. The one who really kept me going with it was my friend Jay Cox and his wife Verna. They showed it to John Cassavetes, And Cassavetes liked this scene a lot. And I used to talk about the scene where in Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Don Siegel version, the Don Siegel version, where Kevin McCarthy kisses Faith Demarag, and he realizes, as she pulls away, he realizes she's been overtaken by the pod people, and she's changed. And I said, I always thought that's an amazing moment. And Cassavetes told me, well, this kiss is better when she pulls away from him. And he said, no, you mustn't be embarrassed by this. This is genuine. And he was the one, based on this scene and these sequences in the film, who encouraged me to ultimately make Mean Streets based on this.
It's incredibly genuine. And in that scene, which is why it was necessary to show the whole of it, there's so many changes that take place, because at first you think they're gonna get together, and then they move away, and the whole choreography of it is really interesting. Yeah. And then I know you get a certain amount of criticism for your female characters, but she's so interesting and so strong and such, and he's crumbling and questioning, and the dynamic is really interesting. And then I think of your other films later on, New York, New York, which is very much about tussle between two creative people trying to keep it together, and just the male-female relationships through your films are so strong. But I know, people tend to think, it's the vulnerability that's so strong.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the films I made depict worlds in which the men usually dictate the action. And not all of them, but many do, and they stand out, I guess. But this was the beginning of it for me. I carried it through to Mean Streets is very little of it, but in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and then in Taxi Driver, where it becomes abstracted, or she becomes the obsession. But then we try to follow it through in New York, New York. And I'm not sure if we were successful or not with that one. But in any event,
I think you were. I mean, I love that film, and I know you. Whenever I've mentioned that, I feel that I'm mentioning one of the less loved ones of yours. But
the problem sometimes for me is that like last night, looking at all those pictures up there and all the titles of the films, and each one is a separate, like for me, universe. I go there and I lived in it, and sometimes I feel that, some I don't want to revisit because it's revisiting when the film was made and the people I knew and how things worked and how they didn't work and that sort of thing. And this is not, you look at a film, you'll see a classic film today and people, it was terrible behind the scenes. People weren't getting along. Nobody knows that. Nobody knows that. But I have the right to say, listen, I don't want to have to sit through that again or to be reminded of it. And that doesn't necessarily mean it was a terrible experience. It's just that the emotion and the psychological traumas that we were going through, I just don't want to do it again. I want to move on.
I really understand that each film is a part of your life, and things were going on at the same time, and so one can't disassociate the film itself with what was going on, as you say.
I can't, and it just happens that certain films were that way. Like The Color of Money for me is, I think, an interesting film, but it was a very sad period in my life. And the film is, I think, a very sad film. It has the fun of that was Michael Ballhaus on camera and Paul Newman, Tom Cruise, Mary Elizabeth, the crew, the cast, Richard Price's script. But I shot it quickly. I came in a day under, and $1 million under budget. But I couldn't go any further with it. I like it, but I don't really... It was a difficult period of my personal life, I think, when I was making the film. And so I don't have very many good memories about it, except for being on the set and shooting, and then editing the film with Thelma, and that was it, Whereas Last Temptation of Christ was an absolute appalling situation, but I could watch that. That one, interesting, I could watch certain sections of it.
Not the whole thing?
Not necessarily, not the whole thing, no.
We've got time for one more clip, which is really important to get to because it's Martin's most recent film, From Killers of the Flower Moon, and yeah, talking of male-female relationships.
Thank you. That's interesting. It's very reminiscent of The Sunset and Who's That Knocking? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know, as I say, I'm allergic to so many things and asthma, and I was never supposed to go outside, but I relish the sense of nature, and I envy those who can really appreciate it and live in it. And so in this film, there's this moment, and that came by, I was talking to, or they were talking to me, actually a man who was a lawyer, a man named Winston Pipestem, who was warning us and telling us that you have to be very, very careful the kind of, the way you present the Osage in this film. And this was the very, very beginning of when we had just gone there for location scouting. And he said, you don't understand, Bill Hale and Henry Rowan, they were best friends. And I was picking up all this information. Then later on, he told me something else. You don't understand about our culture. He said, for example, when I was a young kid, about 5 or 6, I'd be running around my house and my grandma would be there. And then one day I was running around. She'd go, stop it, sit still. Said, there's a storm coming. And she said, sit and be quiet and let the blessing of the storm that Wakanda is giving us, let it wash over us. And we had to sit and let the storm pass and relish, actually appreciate the blessing of nature in that respect. And so I said to myself, that's great, that's the way this scene should end. And we put it in the picture. Because originally the scene was they were drinking and he gets drunk and she can hold her liquor and that sort of. So no, this is more interesting. But it's that sense
It says so much also about the different cultures.
The totally different culture, yeah. In the sense I found with the Osage, it's a sense of giving away, giving gifts, giving. And Leo's group, it's taking, you know. And so the dynamic between the two of them is really interesting too. She knows he's just ne'er-do-well. He's a rascal, you know. Yet she loves him.
Yeah.
And it's based on the real relationship that did end, by the way, with her still attending the trial. You know, she only left him after he was convicted. So that was it. That they broke up. But she really trusted him. She really trusted him. And he loved her. And this is what we also found out from the Osage. And so that's what we thought would be the way into the story, you follow, rather than coming from the outside in, from the Bureau of Investigation coming in and doing a police procedural, trying to find out who did it. We always used to say, when I read the book and I started talking to the people, I said, it's not a matter of who did it, who didn't do it. It's who didn't do it. We all did it. And so I said, well, then the story's got to come from, we know who did it, all of us.
But the love story wasn't what you intended right at the beginning.
No, not at all.
Later on.
No. I was finding my way through with Eric Roth on the script, and we were basing it on the book by David Gran. But that was from the outside in. And by meeting the Osage and listening to them, and working on the script and working on it. And then finally Leo and I meeting, and Leo said, where's the heart of the film? And I said, the heart is really this love story. And he said, well, then I think I should play, instead of the FBI guy, I should play Ernest. And I said, all right. And at that point, we just took the script and changed it completely. And then COVID hit. And so I had a lot of time to sit there with the script and, you know, think about how to tell the story through this love story and have everything around it as normal life, so to speak. Instead, it's a genocide, basically.
Well, it's a good point to stop. I think we have to stop. You've got to go and do some other things. And the time has gone incredibly quickly. But if any of you haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon, you must I don't know if it's already been released here. Presumably, it's been released in Germany.
Is it now?
I don't know.
Has it been released?
You need to see it.
I'm sorry.
but can we all give an incredibly big
thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you.